Guy Can Sing. That's a classic from the 80s. Luke Garrett and My Life. 10 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, our staff biochemist. We consult him whenever things scientific come up. Dr. Don Clark, also a board member at Creation Moments. Don, happy Tuesday. How you doing?
Well, doing well. Thank you, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Morning.
It's a little cloudy day today here in East Texas.
Well, grapes will probably like that rather than that brutal Texas sunshine.
Well, actually, they grow faster in the sunshine than in the clouds. But up to about 95 degrees, the grapes really like it.
Mm-hmm. Get a birdie.
After 95 degrees, they stop growing. Because it's too hot.
It happens to
me
too.
Overkill, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. I was in Oregon last week, and we actually sat down with a high pollutant hoi polloi Pinot Noir maker, and we had glasses, and my brother-in-law said that the new style glass was called the new Portland glass. Well, no, that's not the case. It had a little extra lip on it, but it's meant for a certain kind of wine. And I asked her a question about some new vinery land, and she had the answer to it, that it's located in a particular area that allows ocean currents to come in at night to cool the grapes down. Now that's a kind of a normal thing for the growth and the concentration of the sugars in the grapes. Where does it happen in Texas? Or does it?
Yeah. By the way, Dr. Don is a vigneron too. We should mention that to people who haven't listened to Dr. Don before. He's growing grapes down there, and if you haven't ascertained that already, so where do the ocean breezes come from in Texas? Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. Well, we have the we have the Gulf, but we have other problems with the Gulf because there's a lot of insects.
Is there like a nice breeze off the Rio Grande there?
Yeah. The high plains in Texas is where most of the grape growing occurs, although you can grow grapes with difficulty in other parts of the state. But the high plains area is right now the most actively growing area. Now, it's not the most actively area for wineries, because that's not where the population is.
The High Plains is what, east of Dallas and north? Maybe?
Oh, yeah, it's like Lubbock area.
Okay.
Kind of that area is where it is at least cool enough. It's actually their main problem is being too cold in the spring and having possibly, late freezes that could freeze the buds, and therefore you lose your crop, or even you lose your plants, depending on how cold it gets. But we don't have, for the sake of argument, really cold or cooling breezes that come off the ocean or come off someplace else. But it's just a different growing climate.
And is that just a kind of a theory that the highfalutin Pinot Noir makers in Oregon have developed? I've heard this before from winemakers in Arizona, that they can avoid that because of the altitude. Now, this particular guy was in eastern Arizona near Bisbee, but it was the altitude was and the air was so thin that he said that normal grape growing requires the cooling winds from the ocean at night to cool the grapes down. He says that we don't need that here because of the altitude.
Okay.
You would have certainly cooler, cooler days and cooler nights.
Okay.
You do need a certain number of hours of warm temperatures to mature the grapes. And there's been a lot of discussion about picking grapes at night because you have higher sugar content and the grapes aren't all beaten up from the heat of the sun, for example. So
now here you see why we need to have a biochemist involved when you're making wine. It gets pretty technical, doesn't it? Temperatures and sugar percentages, and you're taking measurements. You just bottled a bunch of wine, didn't you?
Oh, we did. Yes, yeah. We did. We bottled our Sangiovese, mm-hmm. Which is a red wine. It's the primary grape that is in the Italian wine called Chianti. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't add a really dark dark grape to it like they normally do with a Chianti. Ours is primarily Sangiovese.
Now, this was from last year's crop, I would take it.
It's from last year, so mm-hmm. that's correct. And so, we spent spent a good day. This was we did the bottling on Tuesday, and we spent a good day on Monday preparing to do the bottling on Tuesday, and then we spent a couple of hours before we actually started bottling, mm-hmm. Doing the final preparation. Steam sterilizing our cartridge filters and getting everything set up and ready to go.
Got to rinse out all those bottles.
You don't.
You don't
have to rinse them out.
All right.
Because they're virgin glass, and so the theory is that they should be pretty clean. We do blow them out with a puff of nitrogen.
Okay, well, it gets the dust out of there, I suppose.
It's the big pieces.
Yeah. Now, when you put a year on this wine, does it then become 2015 or 2016? Is it when the grapes are harvested, or when it's aged, or when it's bottled? What year goes on the wine?
When the grapes are harvested.
Okay, so it'll be a 2015 wine. Okay.
Right.
See, we learned. I learned something, Dave. You probably already knew that, though.
I didn't know that. I was curious about that too. I thought it was the harvest. Chianti is Caniola and Malvasia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Malvasia Bianca, in fact. Those are the secondary grapes, 70% Sangiovese.
Okay.
As far as the Italians are concerned.
Have to look into that someday and try a bottle of Sangiovese.
Now, yours is 100%?
Oh, pretty close to it. We did add a little bit of Ruby Cabernet to it just to, we had to top off the tank primarily. and every time you, of course, do a fining or you do a racking of the wine, taking the clear wine off of the cloudy sediment, you lose a little bit in the process. And, mm-hmm. of course, whenever you filter, you lose a lot in the process. So, we added some Ruby Cabernet, which is a very dark, nice, rich, dark color, mm-hmm. colored grape. It serves the same purpose as those other secondary grapes mm-hmm. that are used in Italy. But we didn't add enough to it to really build the body that a nice Chianti.
Well,
would
I
have.
Ask you now: wouldn't that sediment at the bottom of the bottle be referred to as perhaps organic residue?
Oh, well, there's a segue if I haven't, you know.
Now look, I'm trying
here. Organic residue.
Okay.
See, that's the other thing you missed out in broadcasting. You didn't get to the segues.
So I ask you, where's another place one might go to find organic residue?
Oh, well, you could go to Poland, for example.
Oh.
And there they found... supposedly a 247 million year old dinosaur bone, and they looked within the bone, as mm-hmm. others have done,
yeah.
and lo and behold, they have organic residue, whole amino acids, mm-hmm. not even oxidized amino acids.
Now, just a little fine point here. A fossil is supposed to be mineralized bone, and that's mineral, not organic stuff, right?
Not necessarily. It depends on how it's how it's found. I mean, if it's found in mud, for example, it's not. Some of it might be mineralized, but it all might not be mineralized. So mm-hmm. I don't know what condition these bones were actually found. Mm-hmm. They didn't really say in the article, but it is. It brings you back to the point of how can you have organic matter surviving? The last time we talked about this, of course, was with Mark Armitage.
Yeah.
And the Triceratops horn that he found, which was pretty much a whole horn.
That was dinosaur bone, not a fossil. And he went to Montana for that. Mark has his laboratory in Southern California. And we had him on the air a couple times talking about soft tissue found in this Triceratops horn, which was dated to 65 million years. But that's, isn't that just kind of an assumption? You find a dinosaur bone and you assume it's 65 million years old? I mean,
well, of course it's, yes, of course it's an assumption, and it's based on sometimes circular arguments, as we talked about before, mm-hmm. as to what layer, for example, the fossil or the bone is found in, and depending on the layer will determine how old the specimen is, because they have dated the layers. And how do they date the layers? Well, sometimes they look at the age of the rocks that are in the layers, but sometimes they look at the fossils that are in the layers and say, well, that's a this is from the Triassic period, because we know we have these fossils in that layer.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a little bit of a circular argument, trying to use the layer of rock or the sediment, for example, to try to date the organisms that they find in there.
Is there a scientific test, a sampling of some kind, a radioactive substance in 247 million year old bones? I mean, how do they date that far back?
Well, they have to use radioisotope techniques, and carbon 14 only works to 50 million years, for example.
Well, I thought that was 50,000.
That is because of the half-life of carbon 14.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take a another radioactive element, for example, that has a much longer half-life, then you can date supposedly further back. And so they wouldn't actually be dating the dinosaur bone or the dinosaur or the fossil that they would find, but they would date the rocks that the fossil was found in, the surrounding rocks, and assume that the dinosaur has to be the same age.
Mm-hmm.
That's questionable in its own right, because how do you know that those rocks weren't, or that sediment wasn't formed a little bit earlier, or the rocks weren't formed a little bit, a lot earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really know the history of where those rocks actually came from. But be that as it may, they have convinced themselves that they know the age of these different layers of, that we see around the world. And depending on where these specimens are found, they now pretty much assume that that layer is X millions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so
and in this case, 247 is the number they pulled out. Yeah,
right. They don't even bother dating, the rocks in the layer anymore. Mm-hmm. They just assume, because this is this is this particular layer that we are finding these specimens, then it's got to be at least this old.
Yeah, but they sound so authoritative when they say so. I'm a scientist, and this is 247 million years old. QED. Thus it is so.
That's kind of like
there's a lot of that. Yes. And therefore, a lot of people, believe it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't really look at the assumptions, and there are a lot of assumptions that go into these things, then you don't really question that, maybe that the dating method isn't quite so accurate, and maybe these guys are off completely.
Yeah, David, I didn't mean to talk over you there.
That's right. It was a comedic point, and the point has passed.
Okay,
the moment is gone.
Already, well,
I was, I've always, my days as an undergrad in anthropology class, I didn't think about it then, but afterwards, and I said, "What these guys are kind of eyeballing this and just kind of holding the thumb out and say, well, let's see this rock over here, yeah, I'd say 74,682,000." 12, and the next one, it's got to be the same age. I mean, the assumptions made,
because they hang out together. That's why.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like if we can find a dinosaur wearing a watch, and the watch is stopped, that's when he died. But we don't have any.
That's a good way to look at it. There, yeah.
No, they don't.
We don't have any of those.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, but here in this particular specimen, okay, so what makes this specimen of interest? One, because they supposedly say that it's almost 250 million years old. That is a key. And yet, we find whole amino acids, and they used a spectroscopic technique that actually you can pick up individual amino acids and analyze them. And the amino acids that they that they analyzed in this specimen all belong to a protein called collagen, and collagen is the connective tissue in all of our tissues. Mm-hmm. And so it's a structural protein, and collagen has a lot of amino acids that could degrade, but lo and behold, they didn't find the degradation amino acids. They found the actual amino acids. So not only is this 250 million years old, but it looks like the proteins that they found, or the protein that they found, possibly didn't have any or very much degradation to the protein. And so you're kind of left scratching your head, how is this even possible? Folks have come up because of the other soft tissue finding in dinosaurs that were discovered a couple of years ago. They have come up with all kinds of postulations as to, okay, this is a possible mechanism for stabilizing the proteins in these animals. And of course, you know, once they're stabilized, then they can last for millions and millions of years. Well, why? I mean, has anybody done any experiments to say, okay, we're going to cross-link, that is, tie these proteins together with iron atoms, for example, and then the iron atoms are going to cross-link it or tie them together, much like I make the analogy to rubber, because rubber is individual long chain hydrocarbon, for example.
It's organic. It comes from trees.
That has been tied together by a process called vulcanization, which is basically burning sulfur, and the sulfur then cross-links the rubber molecules together. And where once you had a flowable liquid, let's say, is now, depending on the degree of cross-linking, a hard rubber, which you got to grind it up in order to melt it down and kind of use it in other things. So they're saying, well, a kind of a similar process happens with these proteins, and we're going to blame it on iron. So the Polish team that actually did the work, they said, well, let's look for some iron in our sample. And so they did, and they found a very, very thin layer of iron on the inside of blood vessels. Now, blood vessels, I mean, mm-hmm. They use the word blood vessels. So they're looking at organelles, if you will, within this 250 million year old specimen, and saying, look, lo and behold, we find iron, so this must be the mechanism for why this early Triassic bone is the proteins in it are stabilized. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, we've kind of solved the problem. Well, have they solved the problem? it's highly, highly questionable any protein is going to last that long, even if it's lightly cross-linked or even heavily cross-linked with atoms of iron, for example, or any other mechanism, because if you get any oxygen at all or water, for example, for any period of time in these samples, then proteins just degrade. You know, if you obviously we know that proteins degrade because when you put a person in a coffin, for example, and you bury them and then you come back several years later, you notice that about the only thing left is the bones.
Mm-hmm.
and if you let that process continue, even the bones would degrade.
It should be called known as prima facie evidence. Now, there's an old saw in philosophical circles that says if you encounter a contradiction, because contradictions cannot in reality exist. If you encounter what appears to be a contradiction, you re-examine your premises. Now, there are two premises here. One is that this sample was 247 million years old, and yet it had soft tissue organic residue in it. The other premise is that organic tissue can't last that long. So to resolve this, you've got to either conclude that this dinosaur is not that old, or you have to find a way to prove scientifically that organic material can last that long. Can that be done? Can you conduct a test that simulates several million years of aging? Is there a way to do that?
Well, you'd have to know what the conditions are and then kind of simulate them in the lab. And I mean, you could, but and that is pretty much impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything you do in the lab, you're saying, well, you know, there is little oxygen and maybe there's, you know, little heat or whatever. And we know the moisture content, and so therefore we can run a test. But this is if you did that and say, well, let's raise the temperature, or let's, because all chemical reactions are highly temperature sensitive, and so the higher the temperature, the faster the reaction mm-hmm. should go. And I mean, that's kind of what's done in the pharmaceutical industry. I worked for a number of years in the pharmaceutical industry, and we would do such things as accelerated stability studies, because you had to know how long your pharmaceutical, your drug basically would last in the bottle. And so you would do accelerated temperature studies. But even with those, you might get initial approval on the shelf life of your product, but the FDA wanted, real temperature, that is, a lower temperature studies, long-term temperature studies done on your sample to prove that your shelf life was what it was going to be. I mean, what you said it was going to be. And this is far more complex because you have a matrix, if you will, a very complex matrix of these proteins inside the bone. So I don't think really in any, actuality, you could possibly do the experiment other than maybe even taking the bone specimen and treating it outside of you take it out of the ground and then you put it in some type of controlled chamber and then start looking at the degradation of the proteins within.
Okay, now so that's one of the two premises you can examine in looking at this apparent contradiction. You can maybe do some testing, you can do some aging of similar materials, you can kind of rough out a conclusion, but apparently you can't recreate 247 million years worth of aging in these amino acids to find out what would happen to them to verify that premise. How come there's such resistance to dealing with the other premise, which is that this dinosaur is not that old?
Well, because it's been indoctrinated into the scientific community, and it's been indoctrinated into anyone that has taken any science course, and by the way, any legal course,
mm-hmm.
in our system today, because they think that evolution is fact, and therefore these long ages is absolutely correct. And so they can't even begin to imagine that these samples might only be thousands of years, for example, as opposed to millions of years old. Now, for young Earth or young age creationists like myself, we have absolutely no problem believing that these samples are pretty much all the dinosaur findings that we find, or around the globe, are the result of the global flood, and the sediments that. Like the Triassic layer, for example, these were all set down at the global time of the global flood, and depending on which layer you're looking at, the different layers might have all been laid down at the same time, or they might have been subsequent tsunamis, let's say, during post-flood activities. That kept building layer upon layer as the flood process and post-flood processes were taking place. We've talked about before that the global flood was a catastrophic. I mean, the most catastrophic event that happened on this Earth. And it wasn't just, it just rained for 40 days and 40 nights. But, Noah and his family and the animals were in the ark based on historical record from the Bible that they were on the ark almost a year before they could come out of the ark. So we know that there was tremendous activity going on post-flood. And we highly suspect that that was the time when the continents, main continent, Pangaea, broke up into the continents that we have today. And those continents spread rapidly across the surface of the Earth. And consequently, there was tremendous volcanic activity. So the global flood explains a lot of things, and I think the global flood is the answer to this this end quote puzzling question as how you could have soft tissue or organic matter in fossils or in specimens that you find that supposedly are 250 million plus years old, or they may even find some even older than that. We always come back to the same issue. What is the best model to explain the data?
You know, as a layman, I'm sitting here listening to this and I'm thinking, well, that's more reasonable than a 247 million year age on these fossils. I think I'm going to start investing in scientific companies that look for evidence of the flood. I mean, that would be the next logical step, wouldn't it? Now that you've got this, let's call it a hypothesis that this was laid down during a flood period. Wouldn't science then start looking for evidence of a global flood? Is that happening?
Well, you would think that would be a logical explanation, and here's the problem. I mean, here's the issue. Even about that, it doesn't take a lot of the studies have been done to show that. Well, these layers over here in America join with the layers over in Europe, the sediment layers that are found, and they're exactly the same layer types. So how could you have that? The only way you could have that is if those two pieces of land were joined together, which was the original research that was done to say that, hey, folks, all of these continents were joined at one point in time.
And establishment science agrees on that point, doesn't it?
Yes. Now, what we don't agree on is how fast the continents moved apart, because the typical geologist will look at processes that are going on today and assume that they were constant throughout history. For example, we know how fast magma or the ocean, the ocean rift, for example, how fast that's coming up and how fast it's moving apart. So we use that rate to say, well, this is how fast the continents were moving apart, which is totally fallacious if you don't know the history of the world.
Well, it rules out a singular event.
It does, and it assumes that you know. And this is very, very common in older age, old Earth, for example, geology, is that they assume, their major assumption is that the rates we observe today are have been going on for eons and forever, and there was no catastrophe that created what we see today. So if you ignore the Bible, if you ignore this historic record that Genesis is a historic record, just like other parts of the Bible are historic records, for example, 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, I mean, the reason why it's called Chronicles is because it's a chronicle of the history of the time, kings, you know, of Israel. So why would you assume then that the very first book of the Bible, which isn't the oldest book, but it's the very first book of the Bible, isn't itself a genealogy, or isn't itself a history book? And the name Genesis, genealogy, would tell you that, oh, maybe this might be related to actual history, and we should look at it that way. But we choose to ignore that because we want to believe that there is no God. And, of course, that goes back to the premise that, which is the same same premise that got will get Satan kicked out of heaven eventually, in that he wants to become God himself. And I think, you know, we see evidence today that there are a lot of people here on earth that want to be little gods and don't want to answer to any higher authority and assume that there are any, you know, moral, basic fundamental laws that we have to live by.
Well, it's interesting that there would be so much resistance to the idea. It's beyond me, I guess. We're talking about an article with Dr. Don Clark that appears in the Institute for Creation Research magazine, and I've just put a link in the chat window on our website that'll take you there if you'd like to read that article. We'll also include the link in the podcast of our conversation this morning a little bit later on. And if this intrigues you, if you find this study riveting, how there could be soft tissue in dinosaurs purportedly 247 million years old, you might like to see a lot of the other side of the story, that is the young earth approach, scientific approach, and you can do that by visiting creationmoments.com. That's the website. There's a Creation Moments graphic on our website over to the left side there, right below Preserving Bible Times, and above Internet Monk, it says Creation Moments. If you click on that, it'll take you to the Creation Moments website, and you'll discover just a wealth of information there, again, scientific in nature, DVDs and essays and books that present the other side in a quite coherent manner, and with a whole lot less fuss and fume than you get from some of the other young earth sources around. So I think it's worth the bookmarking, creationmoments.com.
I have a burning question.
Yes.
Oh, you started the music. I knew it.
Well, you know,
Don, does it seem that there are more of these discoveries recently in the last maybe 4 or 5 years? Or is that just my imagination? I'm seeing one that was discovered in June of 2015. There was another one in November of 2013. I just did a quick search of scientists finding old bones with soft tissue inside. Mm-hmm. You know, does it seem like there's more of them? There's another one for December of 2012. Dinosaur bones with DNAs that is a DNA inside that came from soft tissue. It was a Dr. Schweitzer in that particular case. But maybe it's just my imagination, but it seems like there are more of these examples. Maybe not.
There are more findings because people weren't looking before. They said, "Oh, this is impossible." You know, the so they didn't look, and then when they actually started finding them, then they started looking, and when you look, you find. You know, so I think that's what's going on there. And of course, now it'll probably be routine to start looking at these samples a little more closely and seeing if they find organic matter or proteins or soft tissue or, you know, in this case, blood vessels. Mm-hmm. And they're going to come up with the same result. Any tissue, any bone that they find that hasn't been chewed up by bacteria, for example, is going to have soft tissue in it and proteins in it. So we shouldn't be surprised. Now, DNA is even more susceptible to degradation than even proteins. Proteins are at least a little bit more stable, but DNA. I remember during my biochemistry studying days, we had one of the professors in our department was a DNA specialist, and you couldn't stir the beaker with DNA in it without breaking it.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
I mean, so that's how fragile it is.
And so the debate rages on, and the backpedaling continues, and we'll talk about more such things as Dr. Don joins us again next Tuesday. Don, thanks very much. Appreciate the time today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been fun as usual.
Have a great week. All right. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
So long.